Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shinoshimarks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Thank you again for joining our fourth season, in which we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping industry. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being challenged, replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. And I'm joined today by my co-host, Marco Annunziata. Marco, welcome.
Marco Annunziata, thank you, Diane. Thank you, everybody, for being with us.
So very excited today to dive into this conversation with you, Marco. This has been a really fascinating journey. In this series, we've talked to some of the world's most brilliant minds who are leading noble work. And today's conversation is really just an opportunity to reflect on some of the highlights reel of those conversations, which have spanned a few years now and several seasons. So Marco, before we dive in, your thoughts on kind of what we've accomplished here as a community and some of the highlights of what we're solving for in these conversations.
We've accomplished an enormous amount at the end. I think this is a great opportunity, as you said, to reflect on some of the highlights of these conversations, but also to give our listeners and ourselves a sense of the breadth and depth of the topics that we have covered. I think that the biggest achievement for me of this series of episodes has been to give everybody, ourselves included, a full sense of what the ecosystemic approach encompasses, both in terms of the opportunities and the challenges, right? Because I think as we will see in the rest of our conversation, we have uncovered all the different aspects that the ecosystemic approach to the economy can encompass. We've uncovered a lot of opportunities, a lot of the value that it can unlock, but we've also encountered a lot of the challenges that are still outstanding. And so I think for me, the value of these discussions has really been in it is everything that we are already doing with an ecosystemic approach and everything that remains to be done.
Yeah, that's a great point, Marco. Really, I think one of the central threads that I have really noticed throughout all of these conversations is the degree to which these advanced technologies, the general purpose technologies that really span sector to sector through many industries and reach into our societal kind of interactions, all of these general purpose technologies are beginning to create a kind of a digital infrastructure, if you will, that is necessitating an opportunity to step back and rethink the way that we structure systems of systems, interactions, incentives, and the flow of information. That digital infrastructure and the way that information and interactions and incentives flow and motivate kind of relationships and high value transactions is really, it necessitates a rethink in this digital era. So we'll kind of walk through these episodes. Go ahead, Marco.
Yeah, and I was just going to comment, it's a very important point, and it's something that goes to the core of the entire topic. And it's something that even came up very quickly in season one, as you pointed out, the issue of general purpose technologies of new generation, which are coming up now, artificial intelligence being probably the most prominent. But they've brought up this idea that As we've highlighted, we've entered a period where value is increasingly generated at the intersection of traditional disciplines. Again, to me, this was probably one of the biggest takeaways of season one, especially when you juxtapose it with the fact that we have instead kept moving, we as a society, we've kept moving towards increased specialization. And I think to me, this is probably one of the most interesting points of tension in our discussions, the idea that as you said, we need to recalibrate, we need a new approach, because moving more and more towards increased specialization in a situation where instead the technological change means that it's only by breaking down the specialization barriers that you can unlock values is probably the biggest takeaway of our first round of discussions.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Marco. And in season one, some of the, I think for me, the key points or the real value in the conversations that we were able to host in season one were basically new approaches to understanding and assessing complexity across systems, within and across systems, and new approaches to trade-offs and decision-making. Our good friend, Ed Powell, has spent a lot of time giving thought to the economic value of trade-offs and assigning economic value to both tangible and intangible considerations within complex systems in order to make better decisions given the landscape of options. And for me, I think that's super important as these advanced technologies are increasing the pace at which decisions and actions need to be taken. We need to have better decision-making tools. And also, I think the conversations that we had with folks like Reid Blackman about how those decisions are taken, none of these decisions are now taken in a vacuum. Basically, the pervasiveness of these technologies, the reach of these technologies necessitate a very thoughtful understanding of the ethical implications of decisions and rules within these systems so that the outcomes of the transactions and the experiences within these systems are not compromised for any given actor or participant in these systems. And then, of course, one of my favorite conversations was with Dr. David Bray, and he has such a unique perspective on systems of systems and how we can kind of elevate the way we design these systems in order to drive better experiences and outcomes with these new approaches and methodologies. But all of these really underscore the importance of ecosystemic thinking. Your thoughts, Marco?
I completely agree. I think it's the thinking of your reference to Ed Powell's focus on trade-offs. And there is something that which for me is particularly relevant, which is the importance of marrying the different way of thinking with a new generation of analytical tools. Because looking at everything in terms of trade-offs is extremely important, but at the same time, the idea of having a set of analytical tools which really allow you to capture the complexity of the system and allow you to anticipate what otherwise become unanticipated and unintended consequences of different actions is tremendously important. And I think this is something that, from an operational perspective, it's cannot be emphasized enough, because it's really the step that allows companies, policymakers, everyone of us really to see through the different impact of proposed actions. It's the best way of capturing efficiency. I would also say, for me, this also speaks that the issue of systems thinking, the issue of ecosystemic thinking and approach also speaks to a different attitude and a different approach to innovation. And to me, this, for example, brings to mind one of my favorite conversations from season one, which was with my friend Mickey McManus on the idea of the Department of Strategic Surprises, right? The fact that the best way to create value often is through something which is really surprising, either in a positive way or in a way also that anticipates a negative surprise. But surprise is by definition something which is unexpected and serendipitous. And so this almost oxymoronic or paradoxical concept of creating a strategy to create surprises, I think to me was particularly eye-opening, which is, yes, so you can, in a world of systemic and ecosystemic thinking, you can train yourself, you can set up systems and strategies that allow you to be more systematic and more disciplined in increasing your chances of coming up with something surprising. And I think this, again, is one of the probably the most striking ideas that we've come up with over the course of season one, which are not just eye-opening, but they're also very much concrete, right? There is a big idea, but there is also a roadmap for how to implement it, whether you're a policymaker or a corporate leader.
Yeah, that is so important. I loved Mickey's talks and I love his work. Frankly, he just has such a brilliant perspective on life. And to your point, the strategic surprise methodology that he really so well articulated for us is very consistent with this concept of open innovation, right? That we have been leveraging for quite some time now. And I know the NASA team have been global leaders in leveraging open innovation, but it's this notion of structured serendipity. To your point, Marco, Mickey wisely noted that you have to create favorable conditions so that you can anticipate and harness strategic surprise in ways that ideally are beneficial or that you're anticipating, you know, the strategic surprise that you might need to manage or mitigate. But the methodology that many organizations are using to harness open innovation creates those conditions where you're reaching out to global experts and enthusiasts to help you with missions that matter and who may have ideas that you may never have encountered or dreamed up on your own. So there is a set of tools and, to your point, a roadmap that can help organizations achieve their own structured serendipity or strategic surprise and frankly mitigate some of these external shocks as well that we've seen hit our global industrial kind of base and supply chains over the past several years. So we just need to be designing for a little bit more resilience and a little bit more agility so that we can harness ideas that may not be our own, but may drive value for our missions that matter, or that may help us to mitigate some of these external shocks that we couldn't otherwise weather unless we had these systems where we are able to prepare and react quickly.
Absolutely. And this, by the way, Diane also covers, leading us into one of the topics that has featured prominently in our series and was covered both in season one and season two, which is the issue of the future of work, right? Because the future of work has become a catchphrase used and misused in the popular press. But what you've pointed out is that there is a real question here of how can organizations, whether they are research organizations, government organizations, or corporations, how can they most effectively restructure the way that work is done so as to better achieve innovation, better achieve their goals and results? In this covers, as we've seen over the course of our episodes, a whole variety of issues, right? Both the how work is organized, how your workforce is structured. What is for you, Diane, what are the biggest takeaways on the future of work issues that we've taken away from our discussion?
My biggest takeaway, and I think it's so exciting, is basically the ability that the general purpose technologies are basically unlocking the ability to redesign workforce and basically workflows. So the general purpose technologies allow us to basically put work and workforce on a digital infrastructure that allows us to atomize basically the way we manage jobs and tasks and skills and capabilities, so that because we can access tasks at a more granular level and we can match those with capabilities at a more granular level, we aren't constrained. We're no longer constrained at defining basically work and workforce at a job and a worker level. We can now basically design work and workflows much more at a much more atomic level. And that allows us to match interest and capabilities with greater precision against needs and outcomes. And therefore, we're also able to push work outside of the organization with great efficiency and precision to match expertise outside of the organization. So this, once organizations really start to pick up on these new methodologies, it will be a complete renaissance in how work gets done and workforce gets designed. What were some of your key takeaways?
There is one that really dovetails with what you were saying right now, which is that the more flexible approach to the workforce, so the idea that organizations can now, or they've already started moving beyond the traditional approach where you have an office or you have several offices and that's where your people are and that's on the entire pool of talent that you're relying on, to something which is much more flexible, and flexible in different ways, right? It can be the idea of more flexible working from home arrangements, which will become more widespread after the pandemic, or it can be the idea of more flexible taking advantage of talent, so talent on demand. But there is an element of this which is to the advantage of the individual corporation, which means individual corporations can get access, or organization can get access to a much wider pool of talent depending on the tasks needed and the projects needed. There is an element of which goes to the advantage of the individuals, because the individuals also have more flexibility and greater access to different job opportunities, and therefore greater ability to also cultivate and grow their own skills and their own careers. But there is also an element of it which then strays into the whole idea of urban planning and societal development. And it's something that, again, we have explored during our discussions. And to me, that's a very powerful idea. So and looking at it, Diane, also with my economist hat on, and having seen that in the economic development of countries like the US, but also other Western countries over the last couple of decades, we have seen a dangerous dichotomy with the economic development and economic growth and innovation being centered in very few areas, whereas larger areas of the countries have been almost hollowed out because of the deindustrialization, because of the outshoring of jobs in manufacturing, but also because of the economies of scale that created the concentration of innovation in specific areas, be there in the Silicon Valley or the Boston area. And instead, with these new trends in the future of work, you have the potential for a much more distributed system of both innovation and economic growth. So there is something here that changes the nature of urban development, it changes the nature of the economic development, and can push us towards a more distributed and therefore more efficient and also more equitable in terms of greater opportunities model of economic growth. So that's one thing that to me was a very powerful insight from our discussions on the future of work. And it also dovetailed itself into another discussion that I found especially interesting, which is the future of cities, right? The future of urban development. Because, and again, to me, that brought to my mind an open question, which I have not yet been able to resolve, but it is this idea that a more distributed model of growth, as I've just described, should in principle make cities less important. And it should almost bring your mind to focus more on the diseconomies of scale of cities as being places where which are crowded, where diseases can spread more easily, there's more congestion. And it would almost lead you to think that cities should have no future. If I can have the same advantages by working remotely by a virtual community. But instead, as we've seen in our discussions, there is something in the ecosystemic nature of cities themselves that seems to be irreplaceable and seems to make cities almost a force of nature which will remain extremely powerful in the innovation ecosystem for countries.
Yeah, I was struck by that as well. And I, like you, have not been able to really kind of really wrestle this through personally. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves over the next decade. But because, to your point, opportunity and prosperity are no longer tethered to a zip code, right? Work is untethered. So therefore, so is opportunity, right? Workers have greater agency. They can establish and pursue portfolio careers, balancing and rebalancing where they spend their time, how they pursue their interests, their aspirations, and monetize their capabilities. So they're no longer restricted as they were in the past to zip code based on where the job was, right? They have greater freedom and agency. But to your point, what does that mean for the future of cities and the role of cities in our ecosystemic futures? I, like you, thought that they would become less necessary, although would never disappear entirely. They would need to be kind of repurposed, if you will. But they're in the conversations. It's become clear that cities have a really important role to play in the establishment and persistence of culture and relationships, right? There is something about being near in proximity that shapes a culture, defines a community, and propels an economy in some fashion. So we'll have to see how that shakes out in the decades to come. But I do think that we're going to see a real reset in the commercial real estate as the workforce distribution, right? The remote work settles into kind of the new normal. We're probably going to see a reset or a repurposing of those commercial real estate properties. And it's, to me, interesting to think how those might be reimagined in the decades to come. But
no, absolutely. I think it's worth encouraging our audience to revisit our episode with Tom Cheesewright, because I think he struck me as having really a very balanced approach on this. So probably that episode is probably the best way to try to think through these issues.
Yeah, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And too, Kate Lister has done a lot of thinking in this area. So I think her episode too is a good one. Very closely tied to the future of work and the future of cities is the future of education. And we've had some great conversation with folks who have put a lot of thought into this, not the least of which was the conversation with Andrew Powell. But basically the education of the past is now a very antiquated model, right? It's no longer, our education system can no longer be thought of as complete when we move into the workforce. The education process is now a lifelong journey and actually is much more dynamic because of the rate of change and innovation, both in technologies and business models. The education system has to anticipate more closely the futures that are rolling through the industrial base and try to gear education curriculum appropriately to map to where the markets are moving. But then also adults who are in the workforce need to now consistently refresh their skills portfolio and what they want to do with their career pathways, which are now, as we discussed, much more open to different options. So that the choices for the skills portfolio development are much more dynamic and ongoing. Your thoughts?
Generally, this is one of my favorite topics. It is especially relevant now because over the last couple of years, if not more, we've also seen more and more evidence and more discussion of an identity crisis in the entire education system, especially in universities. And I think there is a lot of it has to do with the fear that technology will erode the competitive advantage of humans, and therefore technology, whether it's robotics or artificial intelligence, will take over more and more jobs. Related to this is, what is the best way to help the humans build the skill sets that can complement the technology most effectively, and whether this should be more focused on building science-related, STEM-related skills, or whether it should focus more on creative, critical thinking skills related more to the humanities. So it's very much still in open field. I feel very strongly that two elements here that we should keep in mind at the end. One is absolutely, as you were pointing out, exploiting new strategies and new technologies to help lifelong learning and lifelong and more flexible building of skill sets. Because there is no doubt that with the more rapid evolution of technology and the changes in the workplace, all of us will have to upgrade our skills much more often and much more quickly. The second element, which is related to, I think, is the importance of focusing in a constructive way on the importance of skills and on the link between the education system and the workplace. Because my concern, these are, if you will, two of my biggest takeaways from the discussions we've had on these topics during our podcast. One is, there is a big risk of ending up with a very defeatist approach. As well, technology is going to take all the jobs anyway, so I throw up my hands and say there's nothing to be done about it. Let just people have fun in university and study what they want and hope for the best. And I think that is, frankly, it's outright stupid, because while technology does pose a challenge, technology is something that we are building. So we are in a position to also look ahead and figure out what is the best constructive and proactive way of facing this challenge. The other part, though, is also to not get carried away, as it's linked, it's not get carried away by a focus on the far distant future. So don't get carried away by an attitude that says, oh, you know, 10, 20, 50 years from now, it's unpredictable, and therefore there is nothing we can do. And to start instead by saying, well, we kind of know what jobs are available now. If we go into the factories, into the manufacturing plants, into the advanced manufacturing industries today, we know what jobs are available. We know a lot of those jobs are in excess supply now, in the sense that it's hard to find workers who are qualified to take them. And therefore, I think the emphasis should really be in a more pragmatic way on building the skills for the jobs that are available now, which are often a combination of traditional factory floor skills with a digital overlay. And then over time, build on them, as you were saying, with an upgrading, a constant upgrading on all the skills, so that these jobs can then become the pathway to successful and high-paying careers. But I think we need to have an approach which is both visionary and pragmatic, which starts by building the skills which we know are in demand now, and then has a system for upgrading them and evolving them as technology takes us forward.
I think that is so important, and yeah, definitely a hopeful and very practical approach for our listeners. It is so easy, as we discussed and you rightly noted, to, as you're listening to all of the hype, all of the headlines around these advanced technologies, to really look at the potential negative outcomes for humanity. And it just, it defeats the purpose, right? So there are very powerful pathways for organizations and individuals alike to harness the power of these technologies. And we have heard, and I would encourage our listeners to really plug back into the episodes, but also the work of our guests like Brian Evergreen, Richard Susskind, Ross Dawson, Phil Hall, all of whom, and others, all of whom had very practical recommendations for paths forward. And some of these individuals actually are offering courses, online courses, to help individuals advance their understanding of these new tools and the ability to basically leverage them to propel certain activities in their professions. Richard Susskind was very uniquely challenging the assumption that jobs are going to be going away. He, I think, wisely counseled us that this is an opportunity for certain professions to become much more elevated in their utility and their service to their customers with the deployment of some of these technologies. I think in season three, we also, one of my favorite themes in season three, and it's continued into season four as well, is this notion of economic anti-fragility. And I would also suggest that anti-fragility as a whole, not just economic, but anti-fragility as it pertains to your career pathways, your mindset, but also the operating models. Ed Powell and Professor Luke Frobe had a great conversation about really the way that generative AI is flowing through markets and models and really challenging our perceptions on intellectual property rights and just kind of rethinking frameworks for systems, economic systems, and how the AI capabilities are unlocking greater potential, but also challenging the way that the old systems have operated. Your thoughts? I know economic anti-fragility is a topic that is near and dear to your heart, Marco.
Yes, it's one of the most powerful topics that we've covered in these discussions. And it also goes back to the entire rationale for our emphasis on the ecosystemic approach, which is the fact that we've entered an era which is feels more fragile, right? Because the economic system has become more volatile and more subject to shocks. Partly for good reasons, partly because through economic development, the global economy has become a lot more balanced with the rise of emerging markets. But that also has created more tensions, more geopolitical tensions, more trade tensions, and therefore shocks, be they coming from tariffs and other trade sanctions, trade wars, or geopolitical shocks of various natures, because clearly a more balanced distribution of economic power also implies that a wider range of countries can now wield the geopolitical power and make it felt. You overlay on this the faster pace of technological innovation and technological disruption, and you have an overall system which is much more subject to shocks. And therefore, the idea of building this economic system, which is anti-fragile, so a system that can absorb these shocks and become stronger through its reaction to these shocks, extremely, extremely important and extremely powerful. It's something we've emphasized over and over. It's something that also, for me, Diane, spills over into some other of the discussions we've had in these episodes. So you mentioned that in the reference to the discussion with Luke Frobe and Ed Powell, is the issue of institutions, right? Because some of the anti-fragility comes from the dynamics of the free market itself, and so the nature of innovation, the way that corporations structure their work, but some of it has to do with institutions. And that brings to my mind one of the topics that I found potentially most fascinating, which is the issue of trust and governance, right? We had a very interesting discussion with Emre Kazım from Holistic AI of this. It's again something which is now very topical. We know that artificial intelligence, especially with generative AI, poses a greater and greater risk to trust, with the potential spread of disinformation, which already is a major challenge. But I think what was interesting is the discussion that we had to highlight how technology itself can build mechanisms that can reinforce, bolster, and buttress trust within society, and through verification systems which are AI-driven. Some of them, again, discussed in some of our episodes, can leverage technologies like blockchain for better distribution of information, contract building. So to me, that's another, you know, talking about the anti-fragility and resilience of our systems, the idea of using these technologies to reinforce trust in society, in our institutions, in a way that is anti-fragile to technological developments, is another of the eye-opening moments that I found in our seasons.
Yeah, I think that is super important, right? Trust is becoming a new currency. And really, it's a very subtle layer across both industry and society, well, and policy, right? Industry, society, and policy, there is this necessary kind of infrastructure of trust that you can see where it is fractured or corrupted in certain systems. And without that foundation of trust, then a system becomes suboptimal. It starts performing in a suboptimal way. So it really getting the right mechanisms in place to buttress the trust, the system of trust, to your point, is so critical, especially where more and more of the interactions and the incentive systems are entering the digital sphere. And I think one conversation that I will be keeping an eye on is the work that Ben was talking about, the work that they're doing to lift policy into code and create a digital infrastructure of governance and policy that is more accessible and more designed by the participants in that community. I think having more agency, more digital and transparent agency in the way that governance is both designed and administered in this digital era could reinforce those systems of trust. So I think some of the work that they are doing is a very fascinating experiment and something that we should definitely keep an eye on. One conversation that I think will also be fascinating to follow is basically this white page approach to establishing a new economy. So in season 4, we had the opportunity to talk to Orbit Nayak about the work that he and his team are doing to establish a lunar economy. So DARPA is engaging an ecosystem around the notion of establishing a persistent economy for lunar and cislunar work. And this is, I think, a unique experiment where we can take all of these lessons learned about ecosystemic wellness and design them into a new economy, ideally. And then conversely, a very long-standing economy that could get a rethink through some of the work that we were talking about in segment 4 or season 4 is this notion of regenerative agriculture. So I think looking at a brand new economy and looking at an age-old economy and thinking about how we can apply some of this new system thinking and methodology is so essential to the future of humanity, but a very interesting set of experiments ahead of us in order to get both of those right. Your thoughts, Marco?
It's a very, it's a fascinating issue, and it's a, you know, it goes to the core of the whole NASA-related aspect of our discussions, which is really the new, the almost blank sheet aspect of space exploration. As you said, the lunar economy is a perfect example of saying, okay, let's get started with something completely new. Let's start from scratch and let's see if we can design something better. But as you pointed out with your reference to the agricultural economy, we can have a blank sheet of paper to design a new economy, but we are coming to it with the legacy of our old brain conditioning. So the way we approach it cannot be really totally new. But it's very important because there's the lunar economy. There's also the fact that as we expand more and more of our activities into space, whether it is for communications, whether it is for warfare, whether it is for mining asteroids and mining new worlds, discovering potential new minerals, or whether it is for eventually disposing of or waste, there is a potential risk that we start spilling over into a new dimension a lot of the mistakes we've already been accumulating on our good old Earth economy. So I think it's that this dimension of creating a new economy, I think it's a very powerful stimulus to rethink the way we've been doing things on Earth. And you mentioned the issue of regenerative agriculture. Agriculture is one of the topics that I found especially interesting in our podcast, because it's not just because it's the primary sector in economic terminology, so it's where economic activity really starts, but also because it's an area where innovation will be crucial if we want to be able to provide efficient and improved nutrition to a global population which is still growing and slated to quickly move from 8 billion people to 10 billion people. If we want to do this in a more sustainable way, rethinking this primary sector of the economy is especially important. But also think of the discussion we had with Minnie Wu on plastics, and thinking of how another aspect of how we're managing the Earth economy, which is recycling, which is the different approaches to try to develop an economy which is more, gets closer to a circular economy, closer to an economy that has less waste, that has more reuse and recyclability of materials. Any discussion like the one we had with Mimi shows you how difficult it really is and how simplistic often our ways of thinking are. We think we've solved it. We think we know how to solve it. And instead, we're very far from an effective solution. So to boil it down, Diane, I think the thinking of the lunar economy or a new approach to the economy through the prism of our approach to space as a way of rethinking more constructively how we are doing things here is, again, one of the most stimulating insights that come out from our podcast series.
I agree with you. I think that just, and we've had so many great conversations, but to your point, I think for me, one of the most exciting takeaways from the entirety of these series is the fact that the decisions and actions that are taken now in industry, policy, and society have implications beyond the traditional scope of industry, right? Nothing is operating in a vacuum. And these general purpose technologies are connecting industries and policy and society in a way that is unprecedented. And so we now have not only an opportunity to design at the systems level, but a responsibility to design at the systems level and anticipating the implications of our decisions and actions beyond the boundaries of our own firm or our own career path. The decisions and the actions that we take have implications beyond. And in order to get that right, we have to design in a very thoughtful manner. And the space economy gives us opportunities, to your point, to learn from the decades behind us and our experience with these new advanced technologies, and to design for experiences and outcomes that really elevate the human experience. And I'm hopeful that this series and these conversations are contributing to some of those better decisions and better actions that will help us carry forward to better ecosystemic futures. Marco, final thoughts?
My final thought is, for me, that perhaps the biggest value of this podcast series is the following. We talked at the beginning about the dangers of increased specialization and the fact that in an ecosystemic world, that the challenge is really to think big, to be able to step back and see the bigger picture, see the whole picture, see the possible unintended consequences, see the interconnections and interrelations between different societal problems and different technologies. And I think our podcast series does exactly this, because as we go through the different episodes and different topics, you can see the whole span of the issues we've covered. You can see how different topics and ideas repeat themselves and connect. You can connect the dots. So for me, the biggest takeaway is this: it's really a stimulus to think big, get the big picture, and then go back into the weeds, create innovations that can have a greater impact, because they've come from a consideration of the interconnections, the synergies, and the trade-offs.
Very well said. Good advice for our listeners. And I would just leave our listeners with this additional advice. If you've enjoyed this conversation, if your curiosity is piqued by any of these topics, we would welcome you to follow us on your favorite podcast source or at shoshimworks.com. And we have more great conversations ahead of us. So thank you again to NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project for sponsoring this series. And Marco, thank you for a great discussion.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shoshimworks.com.